This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour and the part of the program which we call The Big Picture. And Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. And what we attempt to do is, rather than giving you gobs of data points, which there is no lack of on the internet or in the news media, try to explain what we think to be really happening versus some of the narratives that are going on out there. Because remember, in the battle between narratives and reality, reality will always become real. But sometimes it takes narratives a long time to die. Now, that doesn't mean they don't do a lot of damage, by the way, in between, until people grapple with the idea that, wait a minute, there's a difference here between what we're hearing and what's actually happening. You know, when I talk about all of that, Jim, about narratives and changes, think about it. The last 17 years, I mean, that covers the lifespan of this program. We've lived in an era of extraordinary events. There was the attack of 9/11. We have not seen an attack on the United States since Pearl Harbor days, with pretty much the same reaction of people at the time. We have watched as terrorism expanded beyond the Middle East to the United States, to Europe, to Japan, to Australia. In an economic vein, we saw, first of all, right around after the turn of the millennium, the bursting of the tech bubble, which we knew was coming, and which then they tried to blame on 9/11, but it was really a phenomenon in and of itself. And then the bursting of the housing bubble, which was again foreseeable, because we were talking about it for a number of years before it happened here on the program. And that pitched us down into the worst financial recession since 1929. There were moments when it was touch and go, and people were not sure whether or not we were going to stay afloat. Money printing at a level we have never seen before. It's at an historic level of generating new money over such a wide, broad scale, really affecting the entire world. That's a first in the history of the world. And the lowest interest rates in 5,000 years of recorded human history. So what do we call all of this? They call it the new normal. Remember that as you go through a paradigm shift, stage one of the paradigm shift is people think that what they're hitting is a glitch, and with a little effort, they'll get back to it. Stage two is somewhat of a recognition that no, they're not going to get back to where they were, but they keep trying to operate under the old rules and figure out what's happening. And finally, stage three is where the new set of rules become apparent to everybody, but they call it the new normal. So the question I guess we want to ask is, why do they call it the new normal? Because all of these events, geopolitical, political, market-based, we've really never seen anything like this. And something I want to throw in here, Jim, I keep telling people, I said in the 50-plus years I've been doing news work on radio and TV, I have never seen the global media, the established media, go through a meltdown like they have been in right now, and literally throwing much of their credibility in the trash just for the basis of keeping the narratives going. Because before, I mean, I was talking to a gentleman who had been involved in the Whitewater investigation. Remember that during the Clinton administration earlier this week? And we both go back to Watergate days. And I said, you know, when Woodward and Bernstein were doing their investigation, they did have Deep Throat tipping them off and telling them where to go and where to look. But they didn't run with anything in the Washington Post until they had real meat that they could establish plank by plank. And then it was relatively easy to establish who the guilty parties were. Within about 6 months, most of the felons were involved were already off to jail. And ultimately, President Richard Nixon resigned because the articles of impeachment were being drawn up. He was never impeached, contrary to what Mrs. Clinton said. He resigned before the articles could be invoked. But I've never seen this with the media. And also, the best of the capitalist system, all forms of new independent media springing up to fill in the gap left by the narrative's inability to cover what's really happening. So why do we all call this the new normal anyway?
Well, I don't know what normal is, because I would make the point, John, If you take a look at the last 50 years, and if I'm going back to, let's say, 1970, right around the time of Richard Nixon, and this is something you can see, there's graphs out there, and if you want to understand what normal is, I highly recommend you read Sidney Homer's book. He's passed on, but it's been updated by Professor Richard Silla. It's called A History of Interest Rates. It's now in the fourth edition. Gosh, what is this thing? It's close to 700 pages, but it's one of the best books out there. It is the Bible on interest rates. And if you look at historically, over almost 5,000 years of recorded history, there have been a brief moment at the very beginning when interest rates were high, but historically, interest rates have averaged between 6 and 8%. Now, there have been a few brief moments of turmoil when rates have spiked. For example, during periods of war, conflict, we saw it in the Greco-Persian Roman Empire. We saw it in the Byzantine Empire. We saw it in Venice in the 15th century. We saw it in Holland, where interest rates spiked up to over 8% during a period of war. Same thing in England. It got up to 10%. And then, of course, we saw some low spots of interest rates in the 1940s during World War II, when the Fed was monetizing pretty much a lot of the government's debt to finance the war. We saw 10-year treasuries get down to 1.85. But if you take a look at what interest rates have been over, I would say, the last 3,000 years, where we have actually good information, they've been very stable. And this goes back to a remarkable period of time in coming into formation, when we really started to see international trade. We saw the advent of coinage, used money itself. And then, of course, with money, we also had the development of credit.
So what makes it so unusual, Jim? I mean, if we go back to the good old, no days were really terrific good old days, but 1970s, early 80s, I remember my father setting my mother up for the possibility of his demise, and he was able to get great returns on treasury bills, and they were guaranteed, and they had a good yield, and so it was a safe place to put your money.
You know, if you go back, and Sidney Homer talks about this book, and it goes back to the time of Hammurabi, and this was before the development of money and credit, but there were two ways that people borrowed back then. You borrowed in grain or seed, and if you are borrowing in grain, the interest rate was the equivalent of 33%, or if you borrowed in poundage of silver, it was 20%. That's why silver is probably the oldest form of money, going back almost 5,000 years. And John, the other thing too that we've seen outside a few periods of war that we've seen, for example, any kind of war, I don't care, Greek wars, the Roman wars, Byzantine wars, the wars that we saw in the 17th, 18th century, wars tend to create inflation because you have more demand, the government is spending more money. But it was only really in the 20th century that we saw inflations, real high levels of inflation and high interest rates. In other words, if you look at 5,000 years, and if you Google a history of interest rates, 5,000 years, you will see a graph of history that goes back to Hammurabi's time. Most of this came from Sidney Homer's book, and it's been updated. But we were at 20% interest rates in the year 3000 BC. We would never approach that level until 1981. So think about it. In 5,000 years of history, it took 5,000 years to get to the 20% interest rates of Hammurabi's time. Then what we saw in the ensuing next 35 years, we saw interest rates go from a high extreme of nearly 20% to the lowest level in recorded history in the summer of 2016.
You know, and this is something that really hit a lot of people, especially those trying to stay in the old mold, especially if you look at, well, take this back over a number of decades. Go back to the 1980s, we had double digit, high single digit in the 1990s, and then all of a sudden rates plummeted to where we are today. Quite a radical change.
Yeah, quite a radical change. I mean, if you think about it, last year, almost 30-40% of sovereign debt out there was negative. In other words, not only were we looking at the lowest interest rates, but if you loaned the government money, you had to pay the government money instead of the government paying you. That is something we have never, ever seen in history. So the last 50 years, John, if you take a look at from the high levels of interest rates that we saw in the 70s to the extreme low interest rates that we reached last summer, this has not been normal. Well, if you take a look at the tech bubble, it was probably equivalent but exceeded anything that we saw in the 1929 stock market bubble that led up to the Great Depression. So we have seen things that from the tech bubble to the real estate bubble. And I think one of the reasons we have seen that, we spent the 80s, 90s, and the last decade on a debt and credit binge, because much of what we saw in economic growth and growth in the markets themselves were fueled by money and credit. So today, if you take a look around, we have a leveraged financial system unlike anything that has preceded it in history.
You know, and a lot of people, Jim, too, are concerned that we're now seeing a, I'm calling it a 20 plus trillion dollar debt, which is owed by the government. And the servicing of this debt is going to become more and more difficult. And this is going to limit President Trump and, frankly, any future president that comes after him. This is not going away.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just that you have $20 trillion in debt right now, which is the size of the U.S. economy. But, John, at any place that you look, whether you're looking at mortgage debt, it's back up to levels that were pre-crisis. Student loans are at record levels. Credit cards are at record levels. And so I don't think that issue has gone away, or has it?
You know, I want to jump in here on this, too, because we used to hear a lot of chatter about derivatives. I'm guilty of chattering about it on the radio and what a serious risk it represented. So obviously they haven't gone away, but as far as a risk or something in that area?
Well, I mean, the good news is the amount of derivatives in the system have been coming down. They reached a peak in the U.S. with $231 trillion. I mean, think of that. I mean, the U.S. economy is roughly about $18 trillion, and the derivative market in 2010 was $231 trillion. It's now down to about $165 trillion. But here's where the real problem lies. That $165 billion, the bulk of it, almost 90%, is held by just four banks: J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, Bank of America, and Goldman Sachs. So if anything, I guess the good news is, John, a lot of players have gotten out of the business. The derivatives have come down roughly about $60 billion, but the bulk of that derivative market is concentrated with four players. And why that's a problem is these guys own the derivative market. So if there's a problem with one guy, it affects the other guys. There's only four people in the room. Actually, if you take a look at international and bring in the Japanese and European banks here, you've got 10 people in the room. So it isn't a lot of people that you can sell to if you have a problem. And that's one thing that we have seen is a huge, huge concentration of economic power in financial power in the financial system. And Henry Kaufman, I think we talked about this on a previous show. Just to give an example, in 1990, we had over 15,000 banks in this country. By 2014, it had shrunk to 6,300. And if you take a look at those 6,300 banks, here's the astonishing part. 10 banks out of the 6,300 control 80% of all financial assets. So the other 20% of assets are really made up of the other almost 6,300 banks. 10 banks control 80% of the system. That's a staggering amount.
I would think something else too, hearkening back to the days before we had antitrust laws, if you remember, but now we have a concentration of corporate wealth and or power. You're seeing mega companies like Apple. The one I always think of course, is Amazon, because of the tremendous business that does, but there are others. So I would think this is reshaping the landscape as well.
Well, it's occurring across the board. It's not just in the banking system. If you take the S&P 500 companies, the 425 non-financial corporations, meaning not related to finance, either banking or financial related, there's $2 trillion in cash. You've heard this, and the president has made reference to it, about giving a one-time lower tax if the money's repatriated back here. But here's the thing. Of that $2 trillion, John, 61% of it is just 20 companies. I mean, Apple alone has $250 billion in cash. If you take a look at, what is it, about $40 trillion that is in mutual funds, over 50% of that money is controlled by five financial families. We used to have, at one time, going back to the 90s, we had 13 investment banks, major investment banks. At the time, Long-Term Capital Management went under in 1998. There were 13 investment banks that the Fed brought together to bail out Long-Term Capital Management. After the financial crisis today, they've all been gobbled up, and we're down to two investment banks, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. And if you want to talk about economic power globally, 1,400 corporations account for over 50% of world GDP. And of those 1,400 companies, 80% of those companies are Western companies. Close to 60% of them are U.S. corporations. So if you take a look at the last 50 years, not only have we seen extremes in interest rates from high to low, but we've also seen the greatest concentration of economic and financial power the world has ever seen. So to say that this is the new normal, John, this is really the abnormal. And I would say the abnormal has been that way for 50 years, because you take a look at the last 50 years, nothing in the financial world, interest rate world, or the financial markets looks like anything we have experienced here in the last five decades.
Something struck me, too, when we were talking about this concentration of financial power. If we go back to the Great Recession, which was really the most severe, the recession being 2007, 2008, 2009, to the Great Depression, 1929 up until World War II, we have seen this time government and the Fed do things that we have never seen before. Maybe that's another, we talk about concentration of power, where the Federal Reserve and or the government have their fingers in literally every pot of the economic life of the country now.
Well, it is. And corporations have gotten bigger and concentrated, and so has government in power. And it's one of the reasons this financial concentration, it was why it was more difficult for the Fed to implement a normal economic recovery. I mean, we had originally in March of 2009, we had quantitative easing. It was supposed to last a year, and the Fed was thinking that was going to fix it. Well, we got QE2 and QE3, and some say QE4. And also, you got to remember too, John, going back to the first couple months of the Obama administration, we had $1 trillion government stimulus program, not to mention in the last year, in the fall of George W. Bush's presidency, we had the $700 billion bailout of Wall Street banks.
But we've been told, this has been the narrative, that Dodd-Frank is going to regulate the financial industry, and that's going to prevent another crisis or keep it contained. Of course, that was the same statement that was made back in, what was it, 1934 with Glass-Steagall. So that's the narrative anyway.
Part of the problem of concentration started and occurred after, I think it was 1999, they did away with Glass-Steagall, which basically kept investment banking separate from banking. Now you have these huge concentrations. But the problem is the big have gotten bigger. And it reminds me of the old saying, you owe the bank $10,000, it's your problem. You owe the bank $100 million, it's the bank's problem. And that's where we are today. When you have basically 10 banks that control 80% of the country's wealth, and you have four banks that account for 90% of all derivatives, the big have gotten bigger. So the next crisis, whenever that occurs, the government and the Fed will be the only entity that can intervene And basically, John, these four entities are going to be more like public utilities. They have just gotten too big, and that's where we are today. And it's creating all kinds of problems. And unfortunately, Dodd-Frank did not do anything to break these banks apart. You know, the problem is when you only have four guys in the room and they get in trouble, who's bailing out who? Because they're all interlocked together. And this is something that we saw in the financial crisis in the fall of 2008. When Lehman went under, there was a domino daisy chain effect that spread throughout the financial system. Merrill went under. All these other companies that went under and had to be bailed out and rescued and taken over. And as a result of that taken over, the big have gotten bigger.
As we're watching this, and you have sort of a concentration of power, money flows, etc., what do you think the effect of all of this is?
Well, the number one is you're going to have greater volatility, and we've seen that. How many times have we seen sharp spikes in volatility? Because when you think about it, when everybody in the same room comes to the same conclusion on a certain action, whether it's what the Fed's going to do or not do, or a crisis, and they all want to go for the exit gates at the same time, you're going to have more volatility. So there is more limited room to maneuver. I mean, if you have five mutual fund companies that account for over 50% of all the assets held in mutual funds, and they all want to sell a stock, who are they going to sell it to?
I'm going to say me.
Sell it to you, John. Okay. But I mean, they have limited room to maneuver because if everybody comes to the same conclusion at the same time, and that's why you've seen, for example, when you have disappointing earnings by a company, let's say a high-flying company or a company that everybody knows, they announce earnings that miss that nobody's expecting. You can see a company, a blue chip company, drop 20% in a single day. So we're more likely to see the kind of extremes on the upside just as likely as we are on the downside. And you're seeing that today with the Fab Five, the Amazons, the Netflix, the Alphabet type companies that have valuations that are, you know, who knows whether it's going to be Apple or Amazon or let's say Alphabet that becomes the first $1 trillion company. The other thing that you have with concentration as it is today, you have less competition. And the thing that is even more worrisome is governments are now getting into the financial business. Many states now are offering private pension systems. That scares the heck out of me. You know, just think of how they mismanage Social Security and manage how they mismanage everything else, including the healthcare system. My own state of California wants to get rid of all private health coverage in the state and go to a single payer system like Canada. And also, you've got the Fed now coming out with its own rules and also the Department of Labor fiduciary rules. So you got government getting involved in the financial business when they're ignoring the single thing staring them in the eye where the major problem is financial concentration, and they're doing nothing to fix that.
All right, let's put in the crystal ball in its position. And where do you think we are heading with all of this? Because we've got pieces of it here, but I don't see an outcome yet.
You know, I don't know, John, if it's going to be the end of this year or the first part of next year, but we're definitely heading into another recession. We know that happens in a companies anytime the Fed goes on a rate raising cycle. These guys have never, I think there was twice they brought the plane down to a soft landing, and that was 1994, was one period of time. So we're getting late in the tooth in the business cycle. So at some point, either the end of this year or maybe the end of the first half of next year, we're going to be in a recession and probably another bear market. We also know that the Fed, as it raises interest rates, is going to make it more expensive to borrow. And that becomes significant when you have a lot of leverage in the system, whether it's margin debt, consumer debt, student loan debt, automobile debt. We're starting to see defaults in what we call junk car loans right now. And we're also seeing something that this market has risen since November with the election of Donald Trump. As you pointed out earlier, we're seeing a political war waged against the president by the media and the opposition party. So it's very difficult to get anything done when we're spending time captivated by all this superfluous stuff rather than working on trying to get health care fixed because we know Obamacare is imploding. Gosh, it's every single month you hear another major insurer that is pulling out of the health exchanges because they're losing billions of dollars and, you know, trying to get some kind of tax reform. And let me tell you, folks, anytime the government is talking about tax reform, hold on to your wallet because I can guarantee you they're looking for ways to raise revenues, and especially with $20 trillion in debt. So, you know, somewhere down the road, we're going to have another downturn. And the next downturn, John, I think initially it'll be deflationary, both in the economy and in financial assets. But then it's going to be followed by a major, massive reflationary effort. And this time with the Fed monetizing debt or helicopter money. So, you know, once again, this is not, they call it the new normal. I would say it is the real abnormal, and we've been that way for 5 decades, and it looks like it'll be that way for another decade.
And coming up next, part of an interview with Jim Poplava and Gary Schilling on the U.S. debt bomb and financial shocks, looking generally at Dr. Schilling's latest June newsletter as the Financial Sense News Hour continues, and the big picture at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
If you think about AI and artificial intelligence taking over driving, then you start to think, well, what else could AI do better than we could do? Recently, we've seen an AI created by Google beat the world's leading Go players. And Go is considered to be a more complex game than chess, a game that requires even more creativity and strategic thinking. And when I spoke to one of the world's leading Go players, he said that was astounding to them. The speed at which this AI got better at playing the game was remarkable. And it was doubly remarkable because the way that it won by doing things that Go players had never seen before.
Well, there have been a lot of questions about slow growth in the American economy. In fact, this weekend, Barron's did a story called The Surprising Threat to the American Economy, and they were talking about the consumer and the amount of debt the consumer has taken on over the last 3 decades. It blends in very well with my guest this week, A. Gary Schilling, who's editor-in-chief of his newsletter, Insight, and author of the book, The Age of Deleveraging, Investment Strategies for a Decade of Slow Growth and Deflation. Gary, let's talk about this article in Barron's, because it blends in very well with the cover story on this month's Insight magazine called Debt and Finance. In the Barron's article, they talked about one of this consumption boom that we saw in the economy over the last 2 or 3 decades was fueled by a massive credit expansion. They talked about household debt has reached a record $12.7 trillion, which has surpassed the amount of debt at the housing bubble. Interest rates are rising, and consumers, starting with marginal borrowers, are feeling the squeeze. And despite optimism, which is high, it hasn't translated into spending. So let's begin with that article and relate that to the topic you covered in this month's Insight.
Yeah, well, the consumer spending is 68% of GDP in this country, and that's far and away the largest of any country in the world. You look at a lot of European countries, it's more like 60%, India's 50%, China, oh boy, 37% of GDP is consumer spending. They are concentrated on infrastructure and exports, not on the consumer, although they're trying to shift that. But the point is that the U.S. has been an economy driven by consumer spending perennially, and you can certainly say that consumers in this country have never been big savers. And that's particularly true of the post-war babies. In our Inside articles, we've talked about the profligacy of post-war babies right from the time they were just forming households back in the 60s and 70s when they were in their 20s. People then normally spend more than their incomes because they're buying cars and appliances and so on. They're net debtors. But they were even more so, and they've continued that pattern all the way through. As a matter of fact, a lot of these people now are going to have to save like crazy at this point or work till literally they drop dead.
Gary, I want to talk about something that you've written upon in the past, and this goes back to 2015, before the election, and you called it the next big thing, and you made a reference to the movie Network. Howard Beale, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore, but you talk about this mad as hell attitude, both here, the U.S. and Canada, and I wonder what this implies going forward with government. In other words, if the consumer is two-thirds of the U.S. economy and he's restricted because of lack of income growth, job growth, any meaningful job growth of high-paying jobs, and an inordinate amount of debt, what does this imply for economic growth going forward?
Well, it certainly means that if we're going to have rapid growth, it's got to change its composition, or it's got to imply massive government stimuli. I think it's probably going to be more the government action because, again, as you're citing, Jim, voters are mad as hell, and that's not only the U.S., it's really throughout the G7 countries, with the exception of Japan. Japan, they have a different attitude. They've had very slow growth in the economy for 20 years, and it doesn't seem to bother them to the point that they're throwing out governments or anything. Different culture. But anyway, if you look at Europe, Canada, the U.S., you've seen this tremendous turmoil, Brexit. You've seen the election of Trump. You've seen the far-left, far-right parties in Spain, Italy, even Germany. And so voters are really calling for action. Monetary policy, despite zero interest rates, has not really rekindled economic growth. So the pressure is on for fiscal stimuli, and I think that's felt by all politicians, at least anyone who wants to get reelected. And you remember that both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump during the presidential campaign had plans for big infrastructure spending. And so I think this is going to happen. I look for it to actually rekindle real GDP growth of 3 to 3.5%, and that compares to 2.1% average since the recovery started in the middle of 2009. Now, that's 2 or 3 years down the road to get all this done, to get the bills through Congress. And, of course, Trump doesn't have everybody in Congress isn't a friend. He ran against not only Democrats, but against a lot of Republicans, and he's got a lot of problems with Russia and so on. But even when they get it through Congress, then the money is actually on infrastructure spent by the states. And so the states to get tooled up for the environmental impact statements and so on. The administration is aware of this. They're starting to talk about how they can bypass this, and particularly if they get private money in this private-public partnership deal. But those things are going to take time. But I do think that is going to happen. But other than that, I just don't see the makings of big economic growth. Consumers, you know, they're pretty well tapped out, heavy debts. Post-war babies haven't saved. People are nervous about their jobs. The jobs have been created, as you alluded, have been low-end jobs or things in hospitality, retailing, leisure. They're not the high-paid jobs in utilities, manufacturing, and so on. There are a number of reasons, and I talk about a number of these in this article in our June Insight about why consumers are being cautious. So it isn't going to be consumers. Capital spending, that's unlikely to be robust. It's been rather weak, uncertainty, but also you got a lot of excess capacity. And our analysis shows that the biggest driver of capital spending is capacity. When utilization rates are high, people put on more. When they're not, hey, you got plenty of machines that are idle, why invest in more? Yeah, anything that improves productivity is always welcome, particularly in today's world, but you don't see it there. Residential construction, I'm just going through the major sectors of the economy, residential construction, housing. You know, we're seeing a rebound there, but really it's more a shift back to single family from apartments, but there's still a overhang of concern about house prices declining, which they did in the Great Recession for the first time on a national basis since the 1930s. So you just don't have other sectors, state and local governments, they got a lot of debt and unfunded pensions. I don't want to bore people with all the segments of the economy, but you really look at this and you don't have the makings of strong growth except from fiscal stimuli.
So as we take a look at so much of our economic growth is dependent on the consumer, let's talk about other forms of credit. And I want to talk about what you call primary financing, which is either equity or debt financing by corporations. Is that large enough and big enough, Gary, to fill the void to move this economy beyond its 2% growth rate, which we've seen over the last 8 years?
I don't think so. If you look at the non-financial corporate sector, they've actually been reducing their outside financing, debt and equity, pretty systematically for decades. And as a matter of fact, corporations in relation to their total assets now have more cash than they've ever had in the entire post-World War II period. Now, people say, oh, there's all this money parked overseas, and if they change the laws and allow that money to come back and at a lower tax rate, it will. But a couple of things. One is that corporations, say Microsoft, if Microsoft wants to invest in this country or buy back stock or do anything, they can easily borrow, and they do. I mean, they've got all the collateral they need in that billions and billions of dollars parked overseas. Any bank would be delighted to lend them money. So there's no real constraint, and I think even if they do change that tax law, yeah, some money will come back. Maybe some of it go into dividends or stock buybacks. But in terms of capital investments, the type of things that would move the real goods and services economy, I don't think it'll make much difference.
Let's talk about government stimulus, because both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump ran on that. And of course, as we've seen so far this year, whether it comes to repeal of Obamacare, whether it comes to tax cuts, whether it comes to infrastructure spending, nothing has been done. And Gary, you know, as well as I, even with the Obama administration, with the great stimulus program passed in 2009, it was 2 or 3 years before it got actually implemented. And there were a lot of programs that, as the president admitted himself, weren't really shovel ready.
Yeah, that's right. 2 years later, and you're right, Jim, part of that big 2009 stimulus bill, which had tax rebates, tax cuts, and also money to keep teachers employed, but also the idea for the shovel ready projects. Well, turns out they hadn't even made the shovels yet, and they probably would be made in China anyway. 2 years later, only 30% of that money had been spent. And again, it's actually spent by the states, not the federal government. The federal government may fund it, but they have all the environmental impact statements and zoning requirements and draw up the contract specs and so on and so forth. And that takes time. A lot of states just weren't geared to handle that. Now, I think things have improved in the meanwhile, but still, a big program takes time. But I think it's going to happen. And as a matter of fact, if we have something, and I think we will have, just because voters are mad as hell and want action, you know, they've had no growth in their purchasing power on average for over a decade. And for a lot of people, it's actually been declining. It's only the people on top have had rising real incomes, inflation-adjusted incomes. But I think there will be a lot of pressure for that. But as I say, it'll probably be 2 or 3 years before it actually takes place. And one of the fascinating things about this is, how are they going to handle this? And this is not only Republicans, but anybody who wants to get reelected. How are they going to handle this in the election next year? We do have a by-election next year. Everybody in the House is up for election and a third of the Senate. And I think they're going to have to do a big selling job. They're going to have to pass enough laws that they can say to the public, well, you don't see the effects yet, but it's coming. And don't worry, just be patient. It reminds me very much of what FDR did in the 1930s. He was inaugurated in March of 1933. That was they had a constitutional amendment to move it up to January. But anyway, he came in right at the bottom of the Depression. And the New Deal that he was pushing didn't really have much effect for a couple of years, but he did a masterful job of selling hope. You know, the idea of we're behind you, the government is there, you have nothing to fear but fear itself. Masterful selling job. And I think it'll be interesting to see how, not only how Trump, but virtually everybody in Congress who wants to get reelected, how they handle this whole situation this time.
You know, I want to talk about other issues of debt, and that's the big banks themselves. We saw a big bailout during the Great Recession, as many of these banks embarked in areas that were typical or not typical of banking, more in the form of speculation. One thing that we've seen, Gary, which is a little bit concerning to me, is as a result of the Great Recession, the big got bigger. In Henry Kaufman's new book, he alerts us to the fact that four banks account for almost 80% of the assets of this country. Does that concern you in any way when it comes to either debt issuance or speculation in the markets?
Well, it does. This work that you cited on primary issues, and that's the issues of debt and equity by state and local governments, the consumer, non-financial business. And that's what I did my PhD dissertation on at Stanford many years ago. The finance, I look at that as well in this update in our June newsletter. What's the role of finance? Michael Lewis, you know, wrote Flash Boys and a lot of other interesting financial books. He pointed out that finance is a parasite on commerce, but it's a helpful parasite. It's a necessary parasite. In other words, you need finance to move money from the savers to the investors, to grease the wheels of commerce. And that really was traditional spread lending by banks. In other words, they borrow money through deposits or on the open market, and then they lend it with a spread, an increase in interest rates to borrowers. That's traditional commercial banking. But banks, the guys who run them, are not satisfied with being traditional bankers. They wanted to run growth stock companies, so they got involved in all kinds of off-balance sheet vehicles, things that they didn't have to count toward their capital requirements, derivative origination and trading, proprietary trading, a lot of these things that were very troubling and led to the Dodd-Frank law after all the banks had to be bailed out. Well, of course, what happened with the bailout, is, as you point out, is that the banks got even bigger. And the whole idea of breaking up the banks and just saying, okay, if you want to go out and speculate, do that, but don't do it with the depositors' money. In other words, separate the deposit-taking aspect and the loans that to which those deposits are placed, separate that from all these other areas. But that has not worked so far, and as a result, the banks have simply gotten bigger and more powerful, and the whole idea of breaking them up to sizes that are too small, so small they can fail, not to avoid the too big to fail problem, that has not happened. And, you know, the concentration of financial power in this country, I don't think it's a terribly healthy situation.
So as we move forward, one of the things that you talked about, and this refers back once again to the Barron's article over this weekend, is one thing that we've seen of the baby boomers, they didn't save enough. There was a lot of money spent in consumption. And you believe going forward, they will be spending less. And this kind of goes along with what we've seen with the increase in consumer optimism, which has failed to translate into consumer spending on the retail side. So they're more apt to spend less and save more. Let's talk about the implications for that in the economy.
Well, it's obviously it means no big help from the consumer in terms of promoting rapid economic growth, and if anything, a drag. And it's not only the profligate post-war babies, but it's also the fact that as people age, they tend to be more cautious. You know, once you're retired, you don't have that income coming in from a job. You don't have the ability to increase your income by working harder at your job or changing jobs. So there's a natural tendency of people to retrench, and the surveys show this. Even people who can afford to spend more don't. So there are a number of aspects here that I think are responsible for this consumer. And I talk about these in detail in this report. You know, another interesting one is e-commerce. One of the big sale items in bricks and mortar stores is impulse buying. And I don't know about you, Jim, but when I go into Costco, I always end up with a cart full of stuff that I didn't intend to buy. You know, all the people who are cautioning people, unfortunately, I don't have to worry too much about that. I'm not that big a spender. But all the people who are advising people who are on tight budgets, they say, don't go to a grocery store before dinner because you're going to be hungry. You're going to buy more. Draw up a list and only buy what's on the list. Well, obviously, retailers are hoping that none of that is effective. They want people to impulse buy. Well, the facts are that online buyers are less susceptible to impulse buying than bricks and mortar buyers, people in bricks and mortar stores. Now, you look at Amazon, you buy something there and they say, well, you might be interested in this, and they suggest all these related products. But the facts are that that's another reason that we're probably going to see slower consumer spending. So it is a, let's say at a minimum, it's a lack of support for the economy. And again, it does mean that we're going to have to, because I think the saving rate, you know, the saving rate, and here's the point too, Jim, from the early 80s, the saving rate in this country was 12%. And if you flip that around, that meant that people were spending 88% of their after-tax income. Okay. The saving rate got down to 2%, which meant people were spending 98% of their after-tax income. That in itself added about 0.5% to economic growth year after year after year. In other words, you had a whole huge push because people were spending more and more of their after-tax income. Now that's reversing, and I think it will go even higher. The saving rate is now back to about 5%. I think it could go back to double-digit numbers. Another reason is that the post-war babies really need to save like crazy, and they do more as they age anyway. So it does mean that in terms of the economic growth, you're getting reversal. You had a big factor that was a huge promoter of growth, and now it's a drag on growth. And that's an ongoing feature. That's a really a longer-term issue than is approached by the Barron article or the one that we just wrote in our June newsletter. It's an ongoing kind of phenomenon. So it does mean you're just not going to have the growth there, and it'll have to come from someplace else. And as I say, I think it's going to be in the fiscal action Congress and administration.
I want to talk about something that is both deflationary and disruptive. We've seen it in the retail space with Amazon, what they're doing to brick and mortar stores. We're hearing also that soon we will have drones and driverless cars making deliveries. Disruption coming there. But I want to talk about something that also relates to this Barron's article on consumption, talking about the millennials getting out of college with massive amounts of debt. Gary, I want to talk about the disruptive effects of the internet on brick and mortar schools. Do you see that being disrupted in the future? In other words, you know, I read, you know, a cost of a 4-year degree at Harvard could be $250,000, and it could be $100,000 if you're lucky. I mean, $65,000 a year, it's $250,000.
You don't go out for a hamburger and you might make it.
Yeah. But what about the disruption of brick and mortar schools?
That's a whole topic, and you and I could spend a couple hours on that alone, but let me try to summarize our views, and we've written about this in a number of newsletters in recent years. College graduates make 2/3 more than high school graduates. That's the statistics. And most people have assumed that, therefore, that if you go to college, you're going to have a high income. Well, I think the reality is that smart people go to college, but going to college doesn't make you smart. And you know, you can't prove causality with statistics. The fact that college grads make 2/3 more, well, those people would have probably made the money anyway. I mean, Bill Gates never finished. Henry Ford never went to college. You know, that's not necessary. I mean, the causality and statistics are very different. I guarantee absolutely positively, every time there's a total eclipse of the sun, if we beat a drum, it will go away. 100% statistical correlation, but no causality, obviously. Now, I think what's happening is that now that with college grads coming out and half of college grads out 5 years or less are in jobs that only require a high school education. And so people feeling that you go to college regardless, and all these for-profit schools, which have been miserable in terms of graduation rates and job placement, they really fed off this feeling of people that if they get some kind of degree, they're going to make good income. And of course, those outfits operated entirely off of government subsidies, student loans, and government has tightened up on that. But I think people and their parents are more and more realizing that going to college is not necessarily the route to financial success, particularly with the huge debts involved. And I think we're reshaping the education system. Yeah, you're going to have the top schools, the Harvards, the Amherst, where I went, Stanford, where I got my PhD. You're having those schools that are very well endowed, and they don't need to worry too much about what people have when they come out as an undergraduate. They're going to go undergraduate school, professional school, most of them anyway. But then I think you're having the second tier, very fine schools. But parents and students are more and more saying, what am I getting for my money? What am I going to learn that's going to give me the ability to make an income and to repay those college loans? And that's very, very competitive. Third tier are the online learning that you're touching on. And that is, I think the jury's out on that. In other words, how many people are really going to be willing to stick to a online course, and particularly to do it for 4 years to get a college degree or whatever time it takes? There's something to the classroom experience, the discipline of a classroom experience, the camaraderie, interaction with the professors, and so on. Whether that works or not, I don't know. But the fourth tier is one that I'm really interested in, and that is a system that we see, in particularly in the southeast of this country. The Germans have a very strong apprenticeship program, and many of them moved manufacturing plants to the southeast, the Carolinas, Georgia, and so on. They brought with them this apprenticeship program, and they combined this on-the-job training with 2-year college degrees, and they're training people for real jobs, and there's something like 600,000 jobs in manufacturing-related areas that are going begging because people don't have the computer skills. And these people come out very well, and a lot of U.S. companies are now emulating this program, and I think that's going to be an important one, and it may convince a lot of people that a four-year bachelor's degree, particularly from a second, third-tier institution with not much to show coming out except a lot of student debts, that's not the best course of action. But this whole area is in a state of turmoil, but I think the changes are coming, and we'll probably get it sorted out here.
Well, finally, Gary, I want to talk a little bit about your monthly Insight newsletter, which is one of my favorites. I read it every single month. It's usually 30 to 40 pages. It covers the economy, and you really get into depth of some of the key economic indicators. I thought it was coincidental, the front cover of this month's June Insight, and then the article on Barron's this week. But you also talk about financial trends and sort of warning dangers. You were one of the early voices on the housing crisis and the possible debt crisis coming up, and then you put that together with some themes. So if our listeners would like to find out more about your newsletter, why don't you tell them two ways they could do so, either by phone or by email or web?
Yeah, well, one is you can email us for information on this, and the email address is insight, I-N-S-I-G-H-T, at, and then all one word, agaryshilling.com, agaryshilling.com. And by the way, there's no C in Shilling, it's S-H. And the other way is that people can call our toll-free number. It's 1-888-346-7444. And we could give you the information, and if somebody would like a sample copy, we'd be delighted to send you a complimentary version of our latest newsletter.
Well, let me give out that number. Once again, that's 1-888-346-7444. And the website is A. Gary Shilling. That's agaryshilling.com. Gary, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. It's always great speaking with you.
My pleasure. You're a great interviewer, Jim. You're one of the best. And I always look forward to the calls. You got great questions, and you do your homework, and that's very commendable. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and you have yourself a great summer.
Okay. Be talking to you later.
An extended version of this interview between Jim Poplava and Gary Shilling is available on our FS Insider for our subscribers on the premium channel, which aired on Friday of this week. Now, the one thing that really has struck me, you know, we talked a lot about the media, and that is they're focused on this war that's going on between President Trump and his adversaries and the media, etc. Meanwhile, real big problems are forming on the horizon that need to be dealt with, whether it's Obamacare, Social Security, Medicare, the debt situation. Sooner or later, you have to get a budget under control, you know, in order to deal that. One of the rules, if you're digging yourself into a hole, first rule is stop digging, you know, and then see about getting yourself out. And that's what's really striking you if you know what's going on behind the scenes. And in the line of seeing storms coming and the probability of a recession by next year, I guess, is what we're looking at now. What are you doing in terms of prepping for that?
Well, we're doing the same thing that we started last fall, is we're de-risking. So we're no longer 100% invested in stocks because, John, nobody rings the bell at the top. As a lot of the technicians on this program have always commented, it is a topping process. It's a process itself. And I call it look for the generals, because as you get closer to the top, fewer and fewer companies are making new highs. And it's usually the large cap companies that money starts to concentrate in. It's the generals, but they don't ring the bell. We don't know what event, what rate hike or earnings report or what it's going to be that will signal the next downturn. We just know ahead of us, at some point, there's a storm out there on the horizon. We just don't know when it's going to arrive. I got a feeling the next 12 months. And so you take preparation, you take steps. If the barometer starts dropping, you start de-risking.
And as we look forward to the coming week, let me guess. Oh, don't tell me. Wait for it here. FOMC.
Really?
Yeah. We're back in the game again, Jim. Yes. Will they or won't they? Or what will they do?
Well, it's going to be real interesting because this will be the third rate hike in less than a year. So there will be a press conference accompanying the FOMC meeting, and we're going to be looking at what are they talking about the next rate hike, how strong that is, and the big question that everybody wants some clarity on, and they keep hinting on, when are they going to start reducing their balance sheet? Because that is taking liquidity out of the market. They've been talking about it for 6 months. It's almost like when they started to do the taper, they talked about it well in advance to get the market prepared for it. So we're going to be looking for more hints on that. We also have the end of the second quarter coming to a close, and we'll be taking a look at some of the economic numbers and the corporate earnings numbers. We had a good first quarter for corporate earnings, and people are anticipating that will likely continue forward. In the meantime, well, as always, we're out of time. We'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.